Right now, wind southwest at 6. It is 52 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very excited to be able to open today's program with Sarah Ashworth, who is the director of Wisconsin Public Radio. Not all that long on the job, but she is at the helm of Wisconsin Public Radio, just as they are making some fairly dramatic changes. And the announcement officially went out sometime yesterday about some rebranding, some shifting around between the two networks that for a long time have been known as the NPR News and Music Network and the Ideas Network. They will be known by different names. Some realignment has occurred for the sake of creating clarity and, in a sense, greater penetration in terms of the overall listening audience throughout the state. It is a process that has been going on for some time. That is the planning, the research, and so this has not been done by any means overnight. And we're going to be talking with Sarah Ashworth for the next few minutes about what has prompted these changes to be made. We'll talk through some of the impact on specifically the listeners of WGTD, but also we'll certainly be talking about kind of the overarching changes that this will bring about for listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio all across the state. So, Sarah Ashworth, I appreciate you making time in your busy schedule. Thank you for being my guest on the morning show today.
Thank you for the invite.
One of the first things I want to ask you about is that the news release talks about how these changes come on the heels of 2 years of analysis, audience research, and planning. However, you began at Wisconsin Public Radio, I believe, at least as director, just in 2023. I just wonder what it was like for you to take the helm at a point when some of this study and process was already underway.
It made me excited about what was happening at Wisconsin Public Radio. I'll say I applied for the job not knowing that this research, these plans were even in the works. And then as I learned about it, it made me think that this was the kind of station and service that I would love to be a part of and help it grow and adapt to future generations. And it felt like there was momentum and excitement around better serving Wisconsin listeners. I've worked in public radio for almost 25 years. I was out in Vermont at Vermont Public right before this, but I grew up in Minnesota and I was well aware of Wisconsin Public Radio and its long history, 100 plus years, and knew that about the network, but I didn't know that these changes and sort of this new push to better serve all of Wisconsin was underway, and it made me excited about the possibilities here.
It might be helpful at this point to talk about, at least even though the onset of this research happened before you even came aboard, but I'm sure you, as much as anybody, have a good sense of kind of this historical context. What were some of the issues or concerns that prompted this, let's call it a reappraisal of how Wisconsin Public Radio was sort of laid out and organized?
So the research and the conversations at WPR started in the fall of 2021. So the impact of COVID was definitely a part of it. And the changing in listener habits that happened during that time, when you think about, well, you know, well, there's drive time in the morning and you catch a lot of listeners and there's peak listenership in the morning drive time. And then you have another bump of people listening in the afternoon for afternoon drive time. That went away during COVID, and people's expectations of being able to have information whenever they wanted it, however they wanted it, you know, whether that was on their phone or online or streaming audio or finding articles online. And also that many people were finding that news earlier in the day rather than, you know, we have a program, All Things Considered, you know. And for many, many years, that was a place where people got the news that they hadn't been hearing all day long. It was their check-in place. And you can now find, many of us get push alerts on our phones all day long. We get email news alerts. We see that information all day long. So the expectations of what you're looking for and listening for throughout the day, I think, have shifted. And I think people are looking for information and news earlier in the day. And I think there's also, you know, many of us felt this. I certainly have felt it in my own listening habits of sometimes just wanting to take a break from some of the news. And that idea of news fatigue, a lot of people talk about. And I think offering an expanded music service as a place when you can turn to for locally hosted classical music is also a real service to the state. And so I think just knowing that people sort of want what they want when they want it during different times of the day, and being able to provide both of those things, music and news as a service, is what we heard from a lot of people. So we started thinking about rearranging or realigning our two networks so that one would be all news and one would be all music. So you could choose as a listener which service you were looking for at a particular time of day. But I think really those listener habits around COVID shifted a lot of thinking and pushed broadcast media, I think, to think in different ways about how to deliver its service to its audience. And I was in Vermont during that time, but I can speak to there, just it felt essential, the work that broadcast media, all media, was doing during that time, the early days of the pandemic, and making sure that we were a reliable place that people could tune to or pull up online and find information whenever, as I said, whenever and however that they wanted it. So that was what started the conversations. And then in general, I think you could challenge yourself. I do this sometimes when I'm in a store. Look to see if you can buy a radio in person without maybe ordering one online. It's really hard to find a radio today, a physical radio, and recognizing that fewer and fewer people are buying radios and that younger people aren't buying them in the same ways that past generations did. And of course, they're in cars for now, at least. But yeah, recognizing that fewer and fewer people own radios too, and that people are streaming online or on their phones, prompted us to look at how we can better deliver service to people.
Mm. We're speaking with Sarah Ashworth, the director of Wisconsin Public Radio. She began in that post last year. She oversees both networks of Wisconsin Public Radio, which are comprised of 38 stations and 7 bureaus. And we are talking today with Sarah Ashworth on the heels of yesterday's announcement of some changes at Wisconsin Public Radio, some realignment, some relabeling or renaming, if you will, to offer greater clarity to the listeners of Wisconsin and beyond, and to offer services in more maybe sensible ways, given some of the changes in listener habits that Sarah Ashworth was just outlining for us. Could you, again, this is, I'm asking you about something that began before you even came to Wisconsin Public Radio, so forgive this being a slightly unfair question, but I'm sure you are actually very well aware of the nature of this analysis and audience research that has gone on over the last couple of years. In what ways was this question tackled and studied in terms of what we could do better, and in terms of really getting a sense of that from potential listeners around the state? How was that study done?
Yeah, it was pretty comprehensive, I will say. And we worked with Jacobs Media Strategies, an organization that works with commercial and non-commercial broadcast media. And they were our consulting partners. And they helped us do focus groups. And we had focus groups all over the state We heard from people in all regions of the state. We heard from listeners. And then we also talked with people who are businesses that are supporters. So our business sponsorship supporters were also part of focus groups. They shared their reflections. And then we had a large public survey that went out. And I think we sent it out to about 51,000 people, I've heard. And I think about 6,000 sent in full replies, which is a pretty good turnout. And then I will say, we have decades of data that we have collected from people who email or call in with their comments. We have an audience services team that works every day to respond to listener questions, to provide help of how can I find the Larry Mueller Show right now, or why is this host not on the air today? You know, all sorts of questions that might come in every day that they are responding by email and phone call. So over the years, looking at the comments that have come in and the questions people have asked, they are particularly busy, I will say, yesterday and today, helping people sort out what some of the new changes mean. But all of those pieces, and then many of the people here on staff at WPR have been part of discussions and focus groups as well. There's a lot of industry knowledge and a lot of experience within WPR. We have longtime producers and hosts and reporters and people on our development team and in our technology teams that really know the industry well and have many connections around the industry as well. And I think all of that pulled together to start to tell a story of one of the things that has stuck in my head that I heard people refer to is a comment that came up fairly often in all of those responses was, it would just make sense, that just makes sense idea to have news all together and have music all together. It would just make sense. And I will say, in public media, many stations around the country have made this decision and have moved all of their music together and all of their news together. You can look to some of our neighbors like Minnesota Public Radio that has an all-news service and an all-music service. You could look down to Chicago as well. You know, you could look at many other stations around the country who have made similar decisions, and they have seen better service for the audience, and they've seen audience growth come through that streamlined service. So we also looked at those examples. Mm.
So, of course, one of the decisions that you and others faced then was what particular stations to which network they would go. That is, for particularly for those stations that were part of what was known as the NPR News and Classical Music Network. Mm-hmm. So where will they flip? Will they be on WPR News or WPR Music? And just talk through, in a sense, kind of the complexity of that question and trying to figure out which station around the state, there's 38 of them, which station should be part of which network.
Yeah, and I will say, so WPR is a service of the Educational Communications Board within Wisconsin and UW-Madison. So all of us together had large discussions to look at making this decision, and we looked at maps, and our North Star in making that decision was really thinking about serving as many Wisconsinites as possible. So when we looked at like many stations, and you in Kenosha there sort of are very close to the Chicago market, and we recognize all of our signals bleed into other states, the ones especially along our borders. So recognizing where are the ones that really favor Wisconsin audiences, so we make sure that we are serving the people of Wisconsin first and foremost. So that was one of the guiding principles. And then we really looked at making as little change as possible was our hope. So, for example, in Madison, the news and music station where people would listen to Morning Edition and All Things Considered will stay the news channel. So those larger audiences for Morning Edition won't need to make any change to their dial or how they listen over the air on May 20th. So when there were opportunities to lessen the impact of change, we looked to do that as well. I will say sort of across the service, we have, and we have maps up online at WPR.org, and you can see the, I'm really proud of, you know, as you've said, I've come into Wisconsin Public Radio about 9 months ago, but looking at the depth of service we have in the state, we cover geographically so much of the state with our signals and care deeply about providing that universal broadcast access that is accessible and free for many people. And we recognize, especially in rural parts of the state, how important that service is. So making sure that our geographic footprint was large and sort of the circles of our frequencies covered as much of the state as we could. And then there were, you know, our engineers really were part of the conversation too, looking at what was technically possible. And I think through a series of discussions, we all arrived at the maps that we have now. And I, as I said, when I look at how deep the geographic coverage is of the state, I feel really proud of the WPR service that reaches so many parts of the state. If we did have to make a choice, we did favor the news network over the music network for a larger signal if we had to make a choice in certain areas, because we do know at this time that news serves a wider audience.
So one of the changes that is made is that one of the networks will be WPR Music and the other will be WPR News. And so one of the things that is going away is that that name, the Ideas Network. Was there any particular reason why it was thought wise to discard that particular name?
Yeah, we thought deeply about that and talked about it at length. And I will say I'm really proud of the Ideas Network and what it brought to Wisconsin for, you know, 30 plus years. And I think really served Wisconsinites well during that time. We erred on the side of simplicity. And what would most people off the top of their heads sort of refer to the service? They would call that probably the news place or the music place. And so we erred on the side of simplicity, really thinking we want to make it really clear for future audiences too, who are moving into Wisconsin, who are growing up in Wisconsin, who we hope to bring in as listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio. What would make the most sense to them to understand what the services represent? And I will say, of course, news, you know, is a very generalized term too. We have talk programming on there, and on music, we have the bulk of the music service is classical, but there is jazz and world music. We have a wonderful locally hosted world music program, and we have a wonderful folk music program as well.
So just to speak very specifically to WGTD, although I think a lot of our listeners have perhaps already taken a look at the announcement, many things remain exactly the same. For instance, you'll turn on WGTD in the morning, and you will still hear Morning Edition and Dave McGrath's right. Local drop-ins. They will still hear the morning show. That remains unchanged, I'm happy to say. And then it's at 9 o'clock in the morning and through the balance of the day that things change with different offerings that the listeners to this particular station might not be accustomed to. In particular, very significantly, a new morning news and culture program that will begin every weekday morning at 9 o'clock. Tell our listeners about that program and what you envision it providing to listeners.
From 9 to 10 will be Wisconsin Today, which will be a show that has two of our longtime hosts, Kate Archer Kent and Rob Ferret, co-hosting together. And it will be a look at the top news of the day and also a broader look at issues across the state that could be news or could be more more featurey or sort of more about something happening in Wisconsin or what it means to live in Wisconsin today. They're developing the show right now, the team that's working on that. They're working hard right now to be ready for May 20th to launch that show. But I think it will be a vibrant show that reflects life in Wisconsin and engages people all over the state. And as I said, it'll be a mix depending on what's happening in the state. You know, if it's a heavy big news day, say after an election or after another major news event, the show will reflect that. I think it will really reflect what is going on in Wisconsin each day. And it will also have many digital stories that feed out of that show. So we have a team of producers who will work on the traditional broadcast live hour each day. And then we have many of those producers will also produce stories online and other features online so that there's a large digital footprint of the show as well. And I'm somebody who came up through journalism and news, and I've worked on different talk show programs and multi-format shows. And one of the things I love working on them, one of the reasons I love working on them is you start and they develop over time and they grow and you hear from audience members about what they'd like more of or less than. And the show just evolves over time and finds its way. And that's very much going to be the case with this program. So you as listeners, your early feedback, your thoughts, what would you like more of? That's going to be so important to shaping the show over time and having it continue to evolve. And we want it to feel relevant each day. I think that's the overarching goal.
Very good. At 12 noon, our listeners will not be hearing any longer a full-fledged midday news report, something that will be a bit briefer dropped into what is airing on WPR News. And then for the bulk of the afternoon leading to All Things Considered, what will listeners be hearing?
Yeah, so the Larry Mueller Show, which has been on the Ideas Network. So some of your listeners may have been able to hear that on 90.7 in the past. The Larry Mueller Show is expanding from an hour and a half to 2 hours each day. So that live call-in show will be on the air. And Larry does a variety of topics, and many have to do with the most interesting things sort of in our state around wildlife or around gardening or life in Wisconsin, and is heavily influenced by people who call in or send emails and share their thoughts. So that will be the bulk of the afternoon. And as you said, we'll come back to All Things Considered starting at 3 o'clock each day.
And one thing I want to mention is that Saturday, when we have a block of locally produced programming, that at least at this point in time, those locally produced programs like Education Matters and Community mm-hmm. Matters, that block is remaining untouched. And so listeners who are enjoying those programs will continue to enjoy those every Saturday morning. And my understanding as well is that the offerings that we have Saturday evenings in terms of jazz are also untouched. We will be remaining with our own locally produced programming, I think, until 12 midnight when we will rejoin the network. So there is a lot to sort of digest in terms of these changes. And if, as someone who has had a long career in public radio, you know better than anybody the sense of ownership that public radio listeners have, that sense of devotion, but also that sense of responsibility, and that when changes are made, they affect listeners who tend to reach out boldly and honestly.
Yeah.
And I know
yeah.
that you, at least to some extent, really welcome that. I know you are actually planning some sessions in which you are planning to very directly engage with listeners around the state of Wisconsin. Tell us about that.
Yeah, thank you. We have these Learn More sessions that will be around the state. There will be 8 of them or so around the state where people can come and ask questions, share their thoughts. We'll have some WPR swag at each of them and some refreshments. So a chance, I think, for a community of people who really care about public radio to come together. And then I'll be there and some other members of our staff. One thing I will say is we have these bureaus, as you said, we have 7 staffed offices around the state with regional managers, outreach specialists, business sponsorship representatives, journalists, all over the state. We sort of have that and we have a large group of people who work in Milwaukee as well. And so many members of our regional staff teams will be at these events as well. So a chance to ask questions, share your feedback. If we can help you navigate, how do you listen to this show at this time? We would love to do that. But you are so right, and it's one of the things I love about being in public radio is it is so connected. I have always felt so connected to the people who listen. I mean, I'm a listener, you know, and I think I see that also in the people that I've worked with in public radio and very much here at WPR that people who work within the organization care so much about doing a good job for the state of Wisconsin and providing the best programming we can each day, making sure our towers, you know, our signals are working every day and there's uninterrupted service. We have such a talented team of engineers who work to make sure that happens every day. And it's just people who care so deeply about what we're doing. And we connect, I think, together with listeners on that. And yes, you know, this is, as I've said, I guess, a couple of times, I very much consider WPR service to the state of Wisconsin. And so we absolutely want to understand how to do that the best way that we can. And we know that sometimes I've been at stations where we have made similar decisions like this. You've probably all sort of are no longer able to hear a program you once loved, whether it was on WPR or another, or a TV station. You know, programming changes over time and it adapts to where audiences are at. And I feel really committed to thinking about making sure that WPR is relevant and sustainable and around for the long run. We've been around for 107 years, which is the oldest public radio station in the country. And many stations started 40, 50 years ago or so. And WPR has lasted a very, very long time and has made changes over those 107 years. You know, the WPR of today is not what it was when it launched in the early 1900s. And remembering that, too, that we've always evolved and we've always understood what is most needed or wanted and tried to respond to that in the state over time. And I just see this as a continuation of that service and that work that's been going on. Like I said, I'm floored sometimes when I think about people who have worked for this service for over 100 years to keep it going.
It's amazing. And speaking of those who work, you know, to keep this service going, it's perhaps important for us to also mention that in all of these changes and these realignments and so on, no full or part-time staff at Wisconsin Public Radio are being laid off as part of these changes. So sometimes when we hear about changes like this, it's about the bottom line and cutting corners and removing extraneous personnel and so on. These changes are not about that at all. And the good people who work so hard for this network are all going to remain in place, correct?
Yeah, the changes are really driven by adapting to changing audience behaviors. And I will say, recognizing that we do need to bring in new, younger audience members into the service, that our audience in public radio, this is industry-wide, is aging. And so I think we do recognize that reality. And so these changes are driven by meeting the audience where they're at today and preparing for the future.
Do I understand correctly that there is a special website where people can go to, in a sense, view these changes in one place? Did I read that correctly? WPR.org/new?
That is exactly right. Yes, yes. And we have a website there that has, as I've referenced, the maps. We have the schedules up there. There's a FAQ with questions that you may have that I hope will answer. I hope that FAQ is able to answer any questions people have. We do recognize, too, we didn't want to announce the changes and then have them go into effect that same day or the next day because we do know the habits that we all have and the relationship you have with the programming, the programs that round out your day. I've had people tell me over the years that they brush their teeth to the same newscast every morning. Like that's, and they know they're on time for the day if they do. You know, it's that ingrained in people's daily lives. So the changes take effect May 20th. So there is this period where you won't actually be able to hear what this exactly will sound like, what that 9 a.m. show will sound like until May. But I hope that that is helpful, sort of that more people can be informed of the changes and know what to expect, so that on May 20th, you're not scrambling around on a radio dial trying to find something that you like, or where did this programming go, or what is this? You know, our hope is that we can really help guide people to be able to make a choice on May 20th of what they want to listen to and how they want to.
A very good idea. Again, that website where these changes can be found and are laid out in detail, wpr.org/new. You can also offer questions and or feedback at feedback@wpr.org. And the phone number that can be called for listener questions and comments is 844-266-7724. And again, mark your calendar for these changes to take place on May 20th, when WGTD will become part of WPR News. Sarah Ashworth, Director of Wisconsin Public Radio, I really appreciate you taking time out of a very busy schedule to talk with me today. I appreciate this time, this opportunity to speak with you, and wish you and everyone at Wisconsin Public Radio only the very best as we move forward.
No, thank you very much, and we're so happy to work with you and partner and be together on WGTV. Thank you.
And once again, the website where all of this information is available about the upcoming changes to Wisconsin Public Radio, that website is wpr.org/new. And for feedback to Wisconsin Public Radio, you can go to feedback@wpr.org. And that phone number, once again, for listener questions and comments is 844-266-7724. The time is 8:41. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of the Morning Show is from the Morning Show Archives. That's actually one of the few pieces of classical music that probably does not require introduction for most people. Even people with scant interest in classical music or knowledge about it probably have some notion of that being the opening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Of course, you cannot take that for granted when you are talking about young children. And of course, more and more the sad reality is that classical music is something that more and more youngsters are less and less likely to encounter, which makes it all the more important for those of us who care about classical music to take in hand an exciting new book called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. This is a book conceived of and written by Carolyn Sloan, who is a highly regarded musician and songwriter with a long resume involving television, theater, and outreach to children. And she is a music educator at the Berklee Carroll School in Brooklyn, New York. So she knows a lot about how to connect with young children when it comes to getting them excited about classical music and getting them to maybe broaden their horizons, let down their resistance, and be willing to encounter classical music and all that it has to offer. This is a beautifully written book. It, at a glance, looks like kind of a standard, colorful children's book, but it has some sound component to it that is really quite intriguing and helpful. Beautifully illustrated by James Williamson, and I'm very happy to have the author Carolyn Sloan with me for the next few minutes to talk about Welcome to the Symphony. Carolyn Sloan, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
Before we get talking about your book, could you just say a word about the Berklee Carroll School and the work that you do there?
Sure. The Berkeley Carroll School is a pre-K through 12 college preparatory school. It's an independent school in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I teach music there to grades 2 through 4, and I also oversee the lower school music program as well. I teach chorus as well. I think it's really important to, in addition to teaching skills, for kids to develop a vocabulary and a passion for all different kinds of music. And in the last couple of years in my work with kids there, I really started noticing that kids knew less and less about the orchestra and knew less and less about the instruments that even play in the orchestra. I had a third grader who said, well, what's a clarinet? And at which point I said, okay, we have to do something about this.
To what do you attribute that? Because there are a lot of things in the world around us, particularly in terms of technology, that would seem to suggest that anybody should be able to access just about anything. Is it that there is so much open to people now that that certain important things just kind of get lost in this blizzard of information? Or are there other things at work here that would explain why fewer and fewer youngsters seem to know anything at all about classical music?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and it's a big question, and probably, you know, has a couple of different answers. But I think in my experience is that children are kind of inundated right now with whatever is put in front of them. And by what I mean by that is, you know, whatever is the latest thing is sort of all over the place. It's on TV, and it's advertised online, and kids are very, very interested in interactive things, and so computer games and anything that they're going to do in front of a screen is going to sort of take interest and take their focus. And I think parents right now have a really big responsibility in terms of making sure that their kids are being introduced to the things that they feel are important and that they want them to be introduced to. And if for whatever reason classical music is not on the agenda, then a lot of kids are not really being introduced to it. I noticed that even in my school that a lot of the kids had not been to a symphony, and so we started partnering with the New York Philharmonic in their education school day concerts. And I know that any city that has a symphony orchestra, I'm sure, has a really good education department, and it's a great thing to take advantage of because a lot of the time those concerts are subsidized and it doesn't really cost a lot to take your kid to a concert. It's really important. But I think also the advance of technology has really kind of eclipsed classical music, which unfortunately is not a great thing.
Right. And of course, if you're seeing that in a place like New York City, we imagine that it might potentially be an even worse problem in some little town in Idaho or North Dakota or some place where there is no symphony in town and where something like a symphony orchestra is only something you might see a picture of, unless somebody makes a concerted effort to bring this across your path.
It's really true, which is why I was motivated to create Welcome to the Symphony, because I really wanted to reach all kids everywhere, and I thought that if you give them these excerpts of the symphony in sound and you make it immediately gratifying for them, meaning that they can push that button and they can hear the first 20 seconds, that excerpt that you played, and you can hear the last 20 seconds of the first movement, and you can hear all the important themes in the first movement of the Beethoven Symphony, then maybe kids will go, oh, yeah, well, I want to hear the rest of that, which is exactly what's beginning to happen. That's the feedback that I'm getting. The kids are like, oh, I want to hear that. And the whole idea is exposure often and early, early and often.
We're speaking with Carolyn Sloan, a music educator and composer and writer, about the children's book she has just created called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. I want to ask you why Beethoven and why Beethoven's Fifth, although, I mean, at a glance, that might seem like an absurd question. I mean, what better place to start with than Beethoven's Fifth just because it's already such a famous piece. And yet, just because it's famous to the rest of us doesn't necessarily mean that's a great piece with which to try to connect classical music to young people or to get them excited about it. But there's obviously some things about Beethoven's Fifth that you think make it an ideal choice for a book like this. What is it about Beethoven's Fifth that led you to choose it?
I think the very clear and very simple motifs that he introduces in the beginning, the whole rhythmic da-da-da-da, you know, that whole part of it is very easy for kids to grasp right away. And the themes are very distinct and repeat often. And I think that's a key, because when kids can kind of latch on to something they can identify and identify over and over again, the piece becomes familiar to them. And once it becomes familiar to them, then they really like it. And I think, first, I'm a big fan of Beethoven, and you know, I played a lot of Beethoven as a kid as a pianist, but I just love the idea of being able to sort of extract those themes and introduce them to kids and have them kind of immediately identifiable.
So when you decided then that it would be Beethoven's Fifth, take us through your thought process in terms of how you actually went about putting the book together and sort of the journey that you take the reader, in a sense, via three small visitors to the concert hall.
Yes. Well, originally the idea was a pretty simple one. I said, okay, well, I want kids to experience what it might be to go to a symphony, since a lot of them haven't really been. What is it going to be like? From the minute that you walk into the hall, what do you see? What do you hear? And, you know, to make that experience really, really kind of a vital and alive one for them, to the end of, like, well, do we clap at the end of the first movement? Oh, no, we don't. So we thought initially that we were going to use a family going to the symphony, and then we thought, no, you know what? Let's use something like these three little mice who can be sitting in the rafters and experiencing it for the first time. And we found that actually sort of tested better with younger readers. So they walk into the concert halls and they sort of see everybody on stage and they hear them tuning. So that, you know, then there's the button that you can push to hear them tune. Then you see the conductor walk on stage and one of them asks, well, who's that guy? Is he late? You know, and then it's sort of explaining everything almost through the eyes and ears of a very young reader, a young child. And then I wanted to be able to sort of pick out those things that would make the piece really exciting for the readers to listen to. And the whole time I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, well, I don't just want it to be on the page, because quite honestly, as a musician and as a music educator, I had read so many music books to my kids and also to my own son as a parent that had no music, or that had a CD that you had to put into a drive. And now, you know, they don't even make those anymore in your computers. So I wanted it to be very, very accessible. So I said, I want them to hear everything. I want them to hear them tuning. I want them to hear just the violins. And I want them to understand what it means to hear that first 20 seconds, and they're so excited and they're listening, you know, what happens now. And so, I mean, I'm trying to answer your question in the most complete way I can, but I wanted them to sit and listen to it and experience it the way that they would if they were in a concert hall.
Explain, as you start talking about specific instruments of the orchestra, the added component of sound with this book that can serve as such a nice, tangible introduction for the young reader.
Well, I think so many kids don't know what these instruments are, and they haven't really heard them. And that goes back to these music books that are great, but they don't have that oral component where they can really demonstrate what the instrument sounds like. So what's great about it, I think, is you really start to make connections. Like my students at school would press the violin button, and by the time they got to the double bass, they kind of formed their own observations and conclusions about, oh, well, you know, the smaller instruments have the higher sound, and the larger instruments, they seem to have the lower sound. And then they understand the difference between the different sections in the orchestra. And so they understand that, oh, well, these instruments are responsible for these kinds of themes. But then, oh, we hear that theme again played in this different section with the woodwinds. And a lot of kids have never heard of an oboe or a bassoon. And they not have they not heard it or seen it, but they... I mean, they haven't been able to name it, but they don't know what it sounds like. So to make it really concrete for them is a wonderful thing, I think. Mm. And immediately, you know, that's the technological part of it. I was like, well, I don't want to do an ebook. I really love kids to have books in their hands. You know, the whole, well, we can talk about fine motor function after, but it's so great for them to be able to hold the book, but then also have the sound, as if they would if they were sitting next to their iPad or their computer.
Absolutely. I am a big fan as well of holding a physical book in one's hand, and it's nice that this book is that, and yet at the same time, at the touch of a button, allows the young reader to experience some of these moments from the symphony or the sounds of these various instruments. You mention in the afterword of the book that you have a son named Sam.
Yes,
and that you went out of your way to make sure that Sam would be exposed to classical music and you hoped would come to really appreciate it. I'm just curious how old Sam is now, and if those efforts to make this a part of his life ultimately sort of took root.
Well, they really did, actually, and I think it they took root so much it surprised me even. He's 19 now, and he's a sophomore at the Manhattan School of Music.
Ah.
And he plays double bass. And actually, it's his double bass sound that you're hearing in the book. And a lot of the conservatory students in and around New York City, so we have some of the best young musicians in the, playing the sound files in the book. I did go out of my way for him to learn about the orchestra and classical music because I thought, well, you know, pop music is so ubiquitous and he's going to hear it when he goes to school. I don't need to introduce him to that. You know, of course, my husband is a big fan of the Beatles and different music that we listened to when we were growing up, but we just thought, oh, you know, he'll be able to hear that other stuff. It's on the radio all the time. And little did we know that now he's such a classical music lover, he really listens to classical music more than anything else. But we would play it in the car. I'd play it while, you know, he was taking a bath, or, you know, we would play games to it. We were always playing classical music, and I teach classical piano as well, so he heard a lot of it in the house.
Well, it always makes life better when it's when that kind of music is part of it, and so we encourage people who with young children to think about sharing with them this beautiful book called Welcome to the Symphony, a musical exploration of the orchestra using Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, published by Workman Publishing, and the author Carolyn Sloan. Carolyn Sloan, it was great to talk with you, and thank you for creating this lovely book, which we hope will open up the world of classical music to a whole host of young readers.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, We look forward to Kaylee Palomares joining us for her monthly visit to the morning show. She will have with her a fellow staff member from Hawthorne Hollow. And on Friday, we catch up with author Cy Montgomery to talk about her most recent book, published with National Geographic, called Secrets of the Octopus, a beautiful book that explores the many and various ways in which the octopus is among the most remarkable creatures on Earth. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8